The elections earlier this month had some unexpected twists, as so many elections do these days. And for one thing, many Iraqis voted across religious lines, a new trend in a country which has been plagued by sectarian division. Sunnis vote for Sunnis, Shia for Shia. And for another, it marked the re-emergence of the gentleman I hinted at, the Shia cleric, once described as the most dangerous man in the country, Muqtada al-Sadr. Sadr's Syroon coalition ran on a ticket of Iraq First, promising to drain the Iraqi swamp and bring an end to corruption and rid the country of foreign influence. Yes, that does sound a bit familiar. And some observers are drawing parallels between Sadr and Trump. But within Iraq and outside it, many are wary about his rise as a political kingmaker. He was the man behind the death squads which roamed Baghdad a decade ago, targeting Sunnis while calling on the Shia faithful to attack US forces. Now he's calling for a politics which serves the people, builds coalitions with communists and secular parties, and even some Sunni politicians. Margaret Coker is the Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. She joins me now from the bureau. Margaret, hello and welcome to our little wireless program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Margaret, were you surprised by the Sadr coalition doing so well in the election?
Well, it was clear from the weeks ahead of the election that there was a huge amount of apathy among the Iraqi public in general about the state of politics here. And it's also very hard to call elections because there's no reliable polling. So we thought there would be some surprises, but we didn't actually think that Muqtada al-Sadr was going to come out the victor. The fact is, though, that he's captured on this very, very widespread anti-establishment mood that exists here in Iraq, like it does in America and in other parts of the Western world. So as the outsider dark horse, he kind of makes perfect sense right now.
You wrote about the sort of exhaustion that Iraqis feel just by getting through the day, hence their lack of energy in approaching the ballot box. It was the lowest, I understand, since the mid-party elections of 2005.
That's right. Iraqis have, like many growing and even sophisticated democracies, they feel like their political leaders have done them wrong for years and years now. I also found when I was speaking to normal Iraqis around the country that people haven't lost faith in the system. They've just lost faith in the leaders themselves. They didn't see anybody that they actually thought could make a difference. And so, you know, in America, we had that great shining moment when President Barack Obama was elected. You know, now Iraqis are trying to find people that they can trust to change their lives for the better. And here we are with Muqtada al-Sadr for many, many reasons, now being shaped as the man who can break through all the Iraqi barriers, whether it's the history of bloodletting or the history of corruption.
I'm talking to Margaret Coker, and we should make it clear there's no actual winner yet. How will a winner be chosen, Margaret?
Well, so there is a parliamentary procedure here, and the Muqtada al-Sadr's bloc, the Syroon Alliance, they have won the most seats, but far less than the majority needed to form a coalition government. So now we have a bunch of backroom meetings going on in which all of the different political blocs that were participating in the election are going to try and build that majority before the first session of parliament is called. And there is no guarantee that Muqtada al-Sadr will be the person that has the first chance to do that. If others outmaneuver him in these behind the scene meetings, he could be out altogether, and his supporters then could be out altogether.
You know, one of the things which I find most surprising is that he hasn't run for leader, says he doesn't want to be prime minister.
Right. So this is another Iraqi peculiarity. There's many, many political parties here, and it really is a vibrant democracy from that point of view. You also have this this very unusual situation where many of the parties for the last 15 years have been associated with religious movements, both Shias and Sunnis. And in the Iraqi Shia tradition, you have what's known as the quietest movement among the religious establishment here, which means that people as people should take their examples and live moral and religious pious lifestyles. But the political establishment itself stays out of politics, unlike Iran next door. So Muqtada al-Sadr, who comes from a very preeminent clerical family here, has set that example himself. He's personally stayed out of politics. He's never run for office, but as the moral leader of his political movement, he exhibits a very strong role behind the scenes in terms of getting people to vote.
Margaret, in a sense, this tactic makes him even more plausible as when selling himself as a guide or influencer.
Yes, he really is a master of ambiguity from that point of view. You know, he spent years as the spiritual leader of this this very notorious militia that used to be called the Jaish al-Mahdi, you know, the people that were going around with kill lists on them and cleansing Baghdad neighborhoods and setting the country aflame. Well, you know, in many different times over the last 15 years, he has told his militia to freeze all activities. And then when there are more deaths in their name, he's divorced himself from ownership of those actions. And now as a politician, when he has his own political leaders in parliament, he can both tell them how to vote, but also divorce himself from their actions when they do something wrong, like steal money from the poor.
This is LNL on RN. You can listen on air, online, or on your ABC Listen app. And my guest is Margaret Coker. Margaret is the Baghdad Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Now, one has to be impressed by his abilities to bring together an unlikely coalition. He's reached out to commos and secularists and Sunni business leaders. How did he get all these groups to line up?
Well, it really is a masterclass of political talent. He took advantage of the fact that in 2014 and 15, there was this huge security and government crisis in Iraq, right? You saw the creation of Islamic State, and the Islamic State took over a third of this nation. So there was an enormous amount of upheaval. At the same time, oil prices had dropped, and his political base, were hurting, right? It gets harder to keep down a job or even have a job, and harder to make ends meet. So parallel to all of this was this long-standing, long-suffering secularist movement who've been standing up against government corruption and government disaction for years and years. So he basically jumped on their bandwagon. He had his followers join their protest movements that were civil, nonviolent movements here in Baghdad mostly. And after a long period of time, months and months of these kind of small, quiet protests, these two sides came together and started trusting each other more. So what happened was this sort of miraculous thing in which all these sectarian barriers came down. Sadr himself saw that for his own base, who wanted better jobs and more responsive government, and these social democrats and others saw that he could be the springboard to get their message to a wider public in Iraq.
So there's an agreement, in effect, that sectarianism is ruining the country. Now, you've been reporting on Iraq since 2003, since the 2003 invasion. At that point, as we were hinting at before, he was a young Shia cleric. Can you remind us what he was like back then and how he played his hand all those years ago?
Right. So suddenly you had this very free and chaotic nation, right? You had the old order was overturned and people were scrambling for positions of power. Muqtada al-Sadr was very young then. He was in his early 30s and he was trying to make a name for himself amongst this, you know, establishment opposition community. So he invented his own militia and became sort of a Robin Hood figure here, where he was protecting poor neighborhoods against retribution acts and killings. He was distributing food for the poor. And so he has tried to build on this sort of reputation for a very long time. But there are also lots of scores being settled, right? For people who remember Iraq in those days, it was utter chaos. And so there was this very, very, very traumatic assassination in Najaf, which is the Shiite holy city here in Iraq. A very renowned Ayatollah and Shiite leader was killed in the middle of a mob. And the Shiite leadership thought that Muqtada al-Sadr had ordered that assassination. The American military also thought that he had ordered that assassination, but nobody could go after Muqtada al-Sadr. The Americans couldn't go after him, even though they had an arrest warrant, because the rest of the Shiite political classes were too apprehensive about that.
You talked about him coming from a high-profile religious family. Let's go back to this. His father and uncle were both Ayatollahs, but I learned from you that his late father is credited with reviving messianic sentiment amongst Iraqi Shiites.
Right. So he has, his father and his uncles are the people with in the family with a great amount of religious learning, with the clerical titles that in the Shiite world mean that you are a person that should be emulated. Muqtada al-Sadr has always been you know the last in class in terms of the religious authorities here, and so there has been this underdog nature about Muqtada al-Sadr that has always tried to battle his way to both, I think, acceptance and respect, and he's tried for a very long time to work his way up through the firmament of the Iraqi, both political and religious classes. So when it comes to religion, there's few people that trust Muqtada al-Sadr and what he says about religion in terms of being a moral leader for Iraq. But at the same time, he's proven himself to be a political master and mobilized masses when it counts.
Margaret, I'm fascinated to learn that that followers of the family's line believe the prophet's 12th successor disappeared into the Iraqi city of Samarra more than 1,000 years ago and will return to herald Judgment Day. But he's not talking about that sort of thing at the moment.
No, he's not. I mean, his message is for the here and now. It's for the disadvantaged. It's for the poor. It's for the unemployed. It's for the people who have had both their houses and businesses taken because of corruption. So he is not thinking about the afterlife in terms of the Iraqi political sphere. He's thinking about the here and now. And again, he has almost no credibility among Iraqis in terms of what he thinks about religiously or theologically, but his political skills are second to none. Last year, for example, he reached out across to the Arab world and started sitting down with the Saudi crown prince. This is something that hasn't happened over the last 15 years in Iraq. And so there's a certain amount of grudging respect for that. And, you know, he's outperformed his political peers here, as this election shows.
I should have mentioned earlier that both his father and uncle were killed by Saddam's regime. Okay, right. You described his transitional time as a sort of Robin Hood figure. I didn't realize that from 2008 to 2011, he lived in Iran. Why was he there, and what effect did that have on him?
Well, he was there because the rest of the Iraqi Shiite class, political class that is, basically ganged up on him. You know, it was his militia, the Jaish al-Mahdi militia, that even when they weren't setting their sights on American coalition troops, they had made a name for themselves across many Iraqi cities as being the mafiosi. They were involved in organized crime, they were involved in the protection rackets, and they're involved in smuggling. And that added to the general chaos of Iraq in those days. So the Americans considered his Jaish al-Mahdi to be on par as a threat to al-Qaeda, which they were also battling here at the time. The Iraqi establishment, the prime minister in those days, Nouri al-Maliki, decided they had all had enough. They couldn't bring him around. They couldn't tame him or his militia. And so Nouri al-Maliki set the Iraqi army against Muqtada al-Sadr's militia. And from that point on, when you have Iraqi on Iraqi violence and Shiite on Shiite violence, Muqtada al-Sadr wasn't welcome in Iraq. He stayed in Iran in order to basically lick his wounds and come back to fight another day.
It's important to make the observation that he's been at pains to distance himself from Iran in this campaign. So, Margaret, I know you haven't interviewed him, but you must have a sense of him as a human being.
Sure, right. I mean, he has lots of aides who like to speak on his behalf, and you know they do see him on a day-to-day basis. Muqtada al-Sadr has been criticized for being both a maverick and also rather mercurial in his worldview. But one thing that he's always been very, very consistent on is the fact that Americans are seen as occupiers, which is one reason why the New York Times can't get an interview with him. But also now that Iran is part of that global threat or local threat as well to the Iraqis. So he's broadened his view about what an occupying force means. And Iran, because of its very close cultural and economic ties in Iraq, but also its financial ties to these various militia groups that still are a plague for Iraq, that is seen for now, in terms of Muqtada al-Sadr's worldview, as a grave threat as the American forces that used to be here.
Margaret, thank you very much for your contribution to our little program. Margaret Coker, Baghdad Bureau Chief for the New York Times. And this is LNL, and as I promised you, you're about to meet our very first ant, bee, and slime mold wrangler, Music Maestro.